Hello, and welcome to episode 38 of Soft Spot, the podcast of the Global Soft Foundation. I'm your host, Chelsea Hamishin, and I'm also the marketing team at the foundation. Like many of you, we're still self-isolating and, of course, recording all of these episodes virtually. We recorded this one around April 24th, about 2 weeks ago, if you're listening to this right when it comes out. And that's important because it was the 40th anniversary of Operation Eagle Claw. So we put out quite a few different things to mark that anniversary, including a blog and a soft story from quarantine with Rick Lamb, which is videos that we've been doing. If you don't know Rick Lamb, you're missing out. He's a retired command sergeant major who spent his 30-year career both as a ranger and SF in the U.S. Army. Now he works for the foundation as our director of government relations. He's pretty awesome in every way. And of course, we love having him on the team and hearing some of his many stories on platforms like this. So he and I got on a Zoom call a few weeks ago just to record, you know, a short story from quarantine, which of course turned into a much longer 45-minute conversation about what it was like to be a ranger in the 70s, of course, Operation Eagle Claw itself, and Operation Honey Badger, I found out, and then the aftermath of the mission's failure, what we learned from it, and what ultimately came out of it. So listen on and check out the soft story from quarantine videos that go with it on our YouTube channel. Oh, and we start at the beginning talking a little bit about some of the equipment he has in his man cave where he does his recording. So we'll post pictures on the socials and you can check them out there. All right, let's go.
And then if we want to break it down.
Wow. The Global Soft Foundation.
My immediate reaction was, this is awesome. Special Operations Professional
Association for Special Operations. You have our support. Let's move.
Welcome to Soft Spot.
I've got my full field layout.
Of course you do.
To my rear.
What is significant about that? Is that your original stuff?
Pretty much. Yeah. It's the uniform we would have worn, the helmet, the boots, the everything we would have carried, minus the morphine and the live hand grenades.
Well, I'm glad that you omitted those two. So, I mean, while we're talking about what you were wearing at the time, what was it like to be a ranger when you first joined?
You know, it was, you almost have to go back and excuse my long preamble, but you gotta kind of look at the 60s and the 70s in context, because you know, the 60s and 70s were, that was, those were two volatile decades. You had the Cold War going on, and you had all these nations that picked sides. And a lot of times they would just pick sides because the enemy of my enemy is now my friend. And a lot of times we would get close to these dictators who were fighting these insurgencies, and we'd turn a blind eye to some of the stuff they were doing based on the fact that, hey, they're partnered with us against the Soviets. So you had the Arab-Israeli conflict going on. And I mean, that had been heating up since the late 40s. And they had several, you know, battles, wars, and skirmishes in the modern Israel state. Well, that gives rise to this this pan-Arab movement that's got a socialist bent to it that obviously the commies are all supporting. And that goes all the way across, you know, that northern Sahel band of Africa. Starts in Egypt, but it's all the Arab states, because everybody's struggling with all this post-World War I baggage, basically, where they carved up the Middle East, the Ottoman Empire is no longer. And so everybody's looking for these, you know, who am I? So you got the whole Arab, pan-Arab movement going on. And you get terrorism, which is starting to pop up because of the Arab-Israeli stuff, because of the pan-Arab things that are going on. You know, you had Bader-Meinhof, the Red Brigade, all these communist organizations that are bombing discotheques and kidnapping U.S. generals. You know, that happens in the 80s. But you have hijackings and all this stuff. So it's all this turmoil. And then you've got these socialist movements that are Soviet-backed proxies, and they're fighting in Africa, they're fighting in Latin America, Asia, the Middle East, Eastern Europe. I mean, so it's, the world is a volatile place. The U.S. and select allies, we're actually even fighting hot wars in Korea and Vietnam during this time. So, and you see new things popping up, like they're using gas and petroleum and food as weapons. To hold sway against the population. And I can remember pictures of people standing in line with lawnmowers in gas lines, like in 1974, just to get a gas ration to get their lawnmowers started so they can cut the grass. and all these guys are sharing TTPs. So thanks, Russia. You know, they're all sharing all these TTPs across. There was a movie, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was post. You had Israeli athletes that were massacred in the 72 Munich Olympics. Mm-hmm. So there was a movie put out on that. I think Eric Bana played the guy.
Yeah.
And they meet up in the safe house, and they run into an IRA guy, and they run into, you know, so they're all establishing their bona fides.
Yeah.
They're all doing the same kind of stuff. And you got Vietnam going on at this time too, in the 70s. So we finally negotiated.
Munich.
Okay. Perfect. Aptly named.
Continue.
So we're bombing the bejesus out of Hanoi and the Kaiphong Harbor and so we're actually taking it to the North Vietnamese, and they finally cry uncle. So we get them to the peace table and we get basically out of Vietnam. We get everything we want out of the Paris Peace Accords. Yeah, all we had to do was pull back and then resupply bullet for bullet, tank for tank, plane for plane. To the South Vietnamese to keep North Vietnam at bay. 70, you know, Nixon goes out, 74, you know, new guy rolls in, and Congress reneges on the on our, you know, budget to resupply the South Vietnamese. The North Vietnamese roll in a year later, and there's actually more carnage in that year or two purge. You know, communist purge than there was in the previous 13 years of combat. So all this stuff is going on, right? So what do we do as the United States after we get out of Vietnam? We cut the military. Mm. And so you go to what's called they call the Hollow Army of the 70s, basically. Yeah, we in Special Forces, we lose the first Special Forces group out of Asia. We lose the third Special Forces group, you know, focused primarily on Africa. We lose the sixth Special Forces group and the seventh Special Forces group focused on Latin America. They're on the chopping block. And so the only
just got totally canceled. Like they're,
yeah, it's like, hey, we're no longer funded. We're not interested in those areas. So they whittle all these active duty groups down to just two. And you had the seventh group, but they're slated to get axed. And you had the fifth group who's focused on the Middle East with all the terrorism stuff going on. And the 10th group who's focused on, you know, Europe with all the commie stuff that's going on. And those are the two groups that are standing up. So that's the army that I walk into in 1978. So if you go to in 1974, Creighton Abrams, who was a famous tank commander during World War II, he's now the Army Chief of Staff. And he says, man, we're not ready for a lot of the stuff that he sees on the horizon, that he sees in the world. So he stands up two Ranger battalions, the 1st Battalion and the 2nd Battalion. First Battalion's on the east.
Where Abrams tank came from?
Exactly. That is the Abrams tank dude. Exactly. And his son, I think, was also a general as well. In fact, his son, I think, if I'm not mistaken, has got Korea. I think he's the USFK 4-star in Korea. Check me on that.
Okay. Yes, yeah, Robert Abrams is sure his son, so and he is the commander of ROK U.S. Combined Forces Command.
But check my math. So Abrams stands up the Rangers, because he wants a rapidly deployable premier infantry battalion to be able to respond to some of these hotspots and crises around the world. Now, it's called the Abrams Charter, right? So you're going to get more stuff. In fact, Abrams was actually told, hey, why do you treat the Rangers so well? And he says, well, if you want the same treatment, then join the Rangers. So the Rangers would hold Army Plus standards. You know, they actually had the Ranger standard, both physical, mental, and what, you know, the way they operate, everything from haircuts to your personal appearance. And if you failed any of the Ranger standards, then you could be relieved for standards.
Do they allow beards, Rick?
But no, they did not. Hey, this is my quarantine beard. Watch it when I go back outside. If it was a light violation of Ranger standards, maybe you could come back. But you'd have to go through all the stuff from the PT test, swim test, road march, and go through their indoctrination program. It was the Ranger indoctrination program at the time. I think they've since renamed it, but probably the Ranger orientation program. So you could come back. So that's 1974. I joined these cats in 1978. So within a year, my company commander is David Grange. And I mean, he was the guy that I would hold up. Every officer for the rest of my career, you had to meet that template, and very few of them got to that level. And just a terrific guy. I mean, fit, smart, technically and tactically proficient. Second generation Ranger. His dad was a World War II Ranger, or World War II paratrooper rather, who jumped into Normandy. And then his dad was also retired as a 3-star. He held the command at the infantry center, multiple tours in Korea, multiple tours in Vietnam. I mean, just a stud. Another guy that every young Ranger aspired to be just like. And so general, or, you know, then Captain Grange rolls in, and he did Best Ranger before there was a Best Ranger. I mean, the Charlie Company, that company would do Best Ranger competitions for PT, for morning PT. And you would roll out there for morning physical training, and they would say the uniform is, you know, fluff and buff, which was your fatigues, boots, your load-carrying equipment, and your rifle with a sling rope and snap link. And a sling rope is about a 12-foot-long piece of rope that you would make a Swiss seat with for rappelling, or that you would tie around something to carry. And so it was just a 12-foot.
I know you have one behind you. Don't pretend you don't.
Exactly. So it was a 12-foot. This is a 120-foot rope, but it's a 12-foot section of this. Okay. And, with snap link and gloves. So you'd roll out there, and then he had a B team, you know, or a headquarters team that was a little more robust than your regular company. And he would just work those guys to death. So you would show up at your formation area. And there would be a big, long wooden box and full of sand. There'd be another smaller wooden box full of sand. There'd be a litter, you know, a stretcher. Mm-hmm. Then there would be 5-gallon water cans full of water and big ration, cases of ration. So you get a few minutes to figure out who in the platoon was going to carry what. And then you'd mount up, you'd load up, and then you would start in a tactical formation. You have one guy on either side of the road, and you would start on either a 9 or a 13-mile road march that would take you around perimeter road of Hunter Army Airfield. And generally somewhere early in the march, you know, he'd come by and he'd say, this guy's down. And so that guy would go down. You'd have to stop. You'd have to secure the place. The medics would get on him and you know, put a splint or a sucking chest wound bandage or actually insert an IV and bring this, you know, stabilize this kid. Then you put him on the stretcher, and then you got to figure out, okay, how are we going to cross load all the different pieces of equipment that we have, because we have to have 4 guys now carry this litter. And so now the platoon has got a casualty. You're carrying him on a litter plus all the stuff. So about every 2 miles, you would stop. You'd set up in a little, you know, patrol base. And you would have some type of ranger stakes that you would have to do. You know, you'd either have to identify armored vehicles, you know, call for and adjust indirect fire. One time we had to rig a bridge for explosives. You'd have to go up, recon the bridge, you know, see how thick the timbers were, figure the explosives, and then actually do a ring main and, you know, how would we destroy this bridge? Another time we had to push start a deuce and a half. And so one time we had to move an aircraft off the apron, a C-130, and you can actually roll those things. C-130. You have to get up behind the tires and get it rocking, but you could actually get that thing moving.
How many of you were there?
A platoon, you'd have 40 guys. And so you just get on it like ants. We used to pull Jeeps with ropes. I mean, the guy was truly and so then you'd have either platoon size, squad size, or individual competitions as well. Sometimes it would end at the rifle range. And so that's the kind of stuff that we just did for fun. And then all of a sudden, boom, the Iranians take down they take down the embassy. And I think the Shah of Iran, a little heavy handed, but he was pro-Western and he was progressive by our standards. So he was against the Soviets. So therefore he's our friend. But not well liked among the you know, a lot of the population that didn't agree with him. The Islamists hated him because he was pro-Western. Mm-hmm. So when I think he got cancer or got sick, had to leave the country for an operation, and bam, the students and the Islamists take over. They take over the embassy and they take 52 U.S. hostages. So right in the middle of this thing, we the U.S. are trying to figure out, well, what do we do about it.
All right, so we have a special guest for today's corporate partner highlight, Evelyn Pettigrew. She is the daughter of our COO, Megan Keeler Pettigrew, and she's joining me today to tell us about a GlobalSoft small business partner, Blue Light. Take it away, Evelyn.
Blue Light is a strategic IBM business partner specializing in sales, support, and training of the IBM i2 portfolio of products. Blue Light is considered the i2 expert and a one-stop shop for all i2-related products and services, and is the only IBM i2 PSP provider business partner in the USA who is authorized to take first and second level technical support calls. Their instructors are highly experienced, and many came directly from i2. They develop complementary products for i2 customers by creating plugins and connectors. Their customers are from military intelligence, state and local government, law enforcement, and commercial organizations.
Plus, they're currently offering GlobalSoft members a discount on training, so make sure you go to the GlobalSoft member toolkit to get that promo code. Hey Evelyn, where can people go online to learn more about Blue Light?
They can go to bluelightllc.com.
Awesome. Thank you.
So they'd had a team called Blue Light. It was out of Special Forces. They were the guys that actually pulled off the Sante raid. Mm-hmm. And so they were about the best we had at the time on how to do these missions. You know, they'd flown in helicopters deep behind enemy lines, crash landed within the POW camp and did their business. Well, the nation at the time, they're trying to figure out, do we want to keep these guys? Do we want to do something new? And so they were working through the something new, and those that shan't be named. So we're trying to figure out how we're going to do this. So if you have a force that can go in on the point of a target, there's still a large target area that needs to be secured, that where you need to block people that are coming in. I mean, you have to establish a foothold, and for that you need somebody that looks a hell of a lot like Rangers. So the Rangers got the mission to help rescue these hostages, and it totally turned us on our head, because at that point in time, you know, we were in history, rather, we were like Rogers Rangers. I mean, it basic rangering hadn't changed much since the French and Indian Wars, and when we'd get out in the swamps with our paint, and we'd move through, and raids, recon, ambushes. I mean, highly fit. I mean, there wasn't anything that we couldn't do out of FM7-8, which is the infantry squad and platoon. So we had the Ranger Handbook. Most of the leaders, if not all, were Ranger qualified. So it was a great organization to turn to and say, hey, we need you to morph.
So what was unique about the situation that you knew you were going to have to change?
Well, we had to force project, and we needed mobility. We needed the ability to communicate more effectively. And we had to change our task organization was probably the biggest thing, and the mobility. So I remember Captain Grange got us in the day room, and which is like the break area with the pool table and the foosball table and everything. I don't even know if they have them anymore, but it was where everybody would congregate. You know, when you're now they all go downtown, but.
But no, now they're on their phones.
Yeah, exactly. he gets us in the day room, and he sits down, and he tells us, gives us our warning order. This is what just happened. We've got the mission to do this. And then he starts asking us questions like, who in the company already drives four-wheel drive vehicles? You know, who owns Jeeps, and trucks and stuff, and drives them off-road? So the hands go up, and he's got, all right, you guys stand over here. All right, who of you were on farms and have you worked on machinery, you know, could keep stuff running with, I remember this bubble gum and baling wire, and you're comfortable around machines, have any experience as a mechanic? You guys stand over here. Who are our best machine gunners that can shoot on the move from a pintle? You guys over here. And so he tasked organizers based on the strengths that.
Which one were you?
Me, I was a sniper.
Okay.
So, you know, who were the best snipers, the machine gunners, you know, the drivers, who rode motorcycles. And so as he looked at all these guys, because again, he had to develop these skill sets quickly. So he wanted to know who already had those skill sets. And so we didn't have motorcycles. So we went downtown, and I can't remember if it was Yamaha or what dealer, but we went down and we got initially on off-road bikes. So we didn't know if we're going to be more off-road or more on-road, but so we wanted something that could do either. They proved to be not as robust. So we ended up getting mostly off-road vehicles. We got M151, which is the old Willys Jeeps, you know, Vietnam era. And we got those. And so we start scratching our heads and looking at, okay, how many Rangers can we put on this? Do we need to bolt handles to it? Can we get a secondary gun up front? Do we need the windshields? The big thing that was flummoxing us is that we needed to see at night. So we wanted infrared, and they didn't have infrared covers on them. You know, you had these little blackout drives, which is like a little pen light. And
I'm sure it's crazy to see how that's changed.
I know it. It's crazy. We tried infrared paper first in the plastic, and it melted from the heat of the light. I think we ended up going to AFSOC. You know, this is pre-AFSOC, or the Air Force Special Ops guys, and actually getting covers for their they had used with their, and, you know, and bolting them on that they had used on their searchlights. And so figuring all that out was, you know, how are we going to, who's going to drive, who's going to keep it running? Where's the machine gunner? You know, how does he do his business from a pedestal mount? Who's going to sit where? So all the load plans. And then, of course, we got to put them on airplanes and then take them off of airplanes. So we had to figure out, okay, how do you get a center of balance? How do you get this load? How do you get it onto the aircraft?
Do you guys have like engineers helping you, or is it just you jabronis doing it all?
It was kind of us jabronis, but we also had the, you had the Air Force cats who that's their bird, right? So they have to figure out, the center of balance, the load, you know, what they can and can't take, where this thing is going to sit. And in order for the plane to fly. So you did have the engineers, you know, the load masters from those C-130s. And so we get them on, and then you got to chain them down, obviously, and take them off. But at some point in time, you've got to test fire the engine so that you don't have a non-start to get it off the ramp. So when do we test fire engine? But you can't test fire engines for a long time because, you know, you'll asphyxiate everybody. So when do you test fire engines? When do you test fire comms? When do you lock and load your magazines? Who's going to sit where? How do you get the chains up and out of the way? When do you start? When do you get off? So all that.
How much time did you have to figure all this out? Like, what's the timeline from you're finding out you got the mission to actually having to execute?
You know, I don't know. It was a matter of weeks, if not months. I'd have to actually look at when the embassy was taken, and then right up until April 25th, I think it was 24th to 25th. But so we had that amount of time, basically.
Okay.
And so all everything, load plans, time warnings, equipment checks, plus the ability we would have to now take down an airfield. And World War II, you just paratrooped onto it and did your business. But in modern day, when you had vehicles and we had the ability to move those vehicles and you had, you know, a change of equipment, we still sent about a platoon size jump clearing team that would land on the runway and clear it with the PJs to make sure that there wasn't holes or any obstacles on there. And then once they checked that, then you would start air landing. But normally you'd have to take out the barracks. You'd have to strong point secure for any reinforcements. You know, if you had the intelligence on where, you know, who's where and who's going to come the fastest. And so you'd have to do that strong point secure the airfield. Actually, anything that you blew up prior to securing the airfield, you would have to then reestablish. So if you're cutting the electricity, if you're taking out the runway landing lights, then you had PJs who are on motorcycles who are going through and they're putting beanbag lights out so they can relight the runway. And then they do their air traffic control stuff. And then they start bringing in the follow on forces. So the only thing we had to go on from that was Radon Entebbe, which was a movie that had just come out. And again, back from the, you know, the terrorism stuff of the 70s.
You know, wait, Israelis. A movie?
It was a movie, yeah. And it was, I think it was called The Raid on Entebbe. And it was about how the Israelis had gone into Entebbe airfield and because they had hostages taken. You know, an aircraft was hijacked, Israeli hostages were taken, and hey, we're going to kill them unless we get our demands met. So they sent the Israeli special forces. In fact, Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister of Israel, his brother was one of the only casualties of that mission. He was actually the leader of that mission and took an odd angry shot right towards the end of it. But they had gone in, taken down the airfield, rescued the Israeli the hostages and then evacuated them. So we watched how they did it. And that was pretty much all the training that we had to go on.
Wow.
Which was, I mean, exciting times. And that was the one neat thing about Grange was there was no idea too dumb. Because it was just guys, young guys making it up as we went along. And, hey, we can bolt this on here. Yeah, great idea. Hey, if I take this pipe and weld it onto here, I can get a pintle in it. We can have an additional machine gun in the driver's side door. Yeah, great, do it. So just a great time to be a Ranger. And again, a pivotal moment. And we're there again, I think, is my fear, is we get into great power competition. We've got all the two sides lining up. And this will get worse after the coronavirus. You're going to have two sides. I'm either in the China camp or I'm either in the U.S. camp. So as we look at what great power competition looks like and we start developing surrogates, we don't make the same mistakes we made before. But again, we have to start looking at what's coming on the horizon and how is what we're doing today going to change to fit the threats that we know are coming in the next decades.
So speaking of mistakes that were made, what happened with Eagle Claw where things did not go according to plan?
Probably the biggest thing, and I think we've since solved it, but we shouldn't be too cocky. The biggest thing was command and control and planning. So you had different units, disparate units. I mean, the Air Force had their own special ops guys. The Army had their special ops guys, as did the Navy. So as you're looking at that, we had the Rangers, Army guys, the best aircraft that were out there at the time, because we're just starting to incorporate the UH-60 into the Army. So we're still flying skid-mounted Huey helicopters from Vietnam era, right? Some of them actually still had holes in them that were just had 100 mile an hour tape over them. So depending on the unit, crazy, isn't it? So they had so you got these Air Force helicopters, which were the best in the world at the time. They had advanced avionics on them. They were armored up. They were actually the same birds that went into the Sante raid in Vietnam, and the MH-53s. They had a big old 50 cal on a back ramp. So we like that one. So the Air Force guys got the nod, and again, they got the advanced avionics. But then we had to, as Rangers, Army guys, we had to learn, what are the freaks? What are your call signs? What are your standard operating procedures for getting me, an Army guy, on and off your airplane? So once we worked through that, there were some tactics, techniques, and procedures and standard operating procedures that we had to go through. So we're good, right? But then as the plan morphs, they're looking at it and they say, in order to get close, we've got to be able to take off from an aircraft carrier deck. And right then they're like, whoa, you Air Force guys, you're not qualified to do carrier deck landings. That thing's moving. So we got to bring in the Marines. Now, the Marines also had 53s. They weren't as heavily armored, so you could get more guys on it, which is a plus. But they didn't have the advanced avionics that the Air Force spec op guys had. But now you're also putting two units together. And again, so there's the whole standard operating procedures, the frequencies, the call signs, the radios. The Army had their own radios, the Air Force had their own radios, and the Marines had their own radios. And so how are we going to get all this stuff to talk? And so as they're working through all of that kind of stuff, the clock is ticking, and we got to do something. The whole command and control piece as well. We hadn't done a combined mission like that of that magnitude, where we would have to assemble, force project, and then execute, and then get out of there before the reinforcements show up. We hadn't done that since probably Vietnam, 7 years earlier. So all that stuff had atrophied. So that was the biggest thing. I think, so quite frankly, intelligence was another gap. Mm. We had lost a lot of, when the embassy closed down, we lost a lot of our human sources. We had guys on the ground that were giving us great intelligence. I mean, we would get actual pictures of the lock we would have to cut. We were actually getting pictures of the guy we would have to shoot, the radios that they were carrying.
How are they sending it out?
I would get it in a black and white photo. So
you're like, I don't know how I got it, but it's here.
Exactly. Yeah. We had decent imagery. We had pretty good human. And again, it was probably parts of our, that network of spies and informants that had stayed behind. Mm. It was still there. I know they had sent some of our classified units in there to gather more information and intelligence. So, but one of the things that we didn't have, and I think as Americans we're prone to dismiss, is the desert. And we keep making the same mistake over and over. And I've made that mistake myself since, is that we look at a big ass expanse of desert and we think nobody lives there. In actuality, a lot of people live there. You know, there's nomads that cross it constantly. I mean, if your country is mostly desert, you're going to live in it. And so as we picked the Desert One airstrip, and we did not expect traffic at that time of the morning on that road in the desert. And lo and behold, there's traffic. You know, big old tanker rolls through, you know, petrol tanker rolls through. They fail to stop. So the Rangers, the security element pops a law into their cab and stops the truck. There's a bus that rolls through with about 48, 49 people on it. And so we pull them. They did stop. We pull them off to the side. We pan them up. So now you got POWs. Mm-hmm. And they're not even combatants. You know, they're just regular.
They were just on the bus.
Trying to get somewhere. So you got that going on. So there were some intelligence gaps that, hey, we did not expect people. So now the mission's already blown at that point. You know, it's not blown, but at least compromised. Mm-hmm. And then the weather is another thing. They got these things called haboobs. And haboobs is a big old dust storm.
I like that pictures when you sent me your article. I was like, that is terrifying looking.
Oh, it's crazy. And they just roll in from nowhere. And so all of a sudden you got these aircraft that take off and they're moving in and they're stuck in a haboob. And again, you got this disparity between the navigational equipment on the two. So they're trying to stay together. They get separated. They finally start piecemealing into, they all make it to the, to the Desert One landing strip. And, but one of them shuts down and they can't get it crank back up. You know, you got the old blue light, the red light that's blinking, and it's like, I don't know, do we want to try it? And again, two different, maybe the Air Force guys would have said yes, or the Marine guys would have said yes, but maybe
they try turning it off and then turning it back on.
Yeah, because I mean, and again, it's the dust, the sand, it's killing these engine parts. Mm-hmm. And because again, the filters, we know so much more now about flying in brownout and flying in dust and how those machines operate. At that time, not so much. Mm-hmm. So now we have a conundrum in that we don't have enough lift. You know, with one bird down, we don't have enough lift to get all the assault force up into the mountains for remain overnight and then go in and take execute the mission in the next period of darkness. Mm. So we didn't have enough time to obviously clean up that site, get all the guys on the birds enough lift to get in. So they called the mission. One of the other problems was not all the aircraft had in-flight refuel booms. That's why we had to land there in the desert in order to refuel. In order to refuel, you had to fly the helicopter up to the nose of the big old C-130 tanker that is full of gas. Mm-hmm. And in brownout conditions, and then a guy comes out with a freaking hose and hooks it up and fills it, tops you off. So as they're trying to do that, and again, the mission's already blown, it's already been canceled. So they're just trying to fuel up so they can get everybody out of there. Mm-hmm. And the nearest they can figure is that you always have a ground guide, you know, whenever planes and vehicles are moving. And so this young kid is doing this and he's bringing the helicopter in close enough to get the hose out to him. And the prop wash on those 53s, you know, blows him back a little bit. And so as he's going like this, mm-hmm. The bird gets too close to the C-130, clips it, hits one of the oxygen tanks, I think, in the front wheel well, and boom, the thing goes up, and then 8 servicemen die. And so big kick in the jimmies, the loss of life, but then also the ability that, hey, America can't launch a raid like this. Yeah. And so that's what Admiral Holloway got to the bottom of. And his, you know, it was Admiral Holloway. I mean, I think he was a chief of naval operations, retired. And he was actually given the nod to figure out, hey, why did we screw this up? Why did this thing fail? Because literally, I think in each and every piece, like the Marine pilots were the best in the Marine Corps. You know, the Air Force guys were the best pilots and the best birds that we could bring to bear. The Rangers were the best infantry. I mean, so everybody was the best in the world at what they did. But there was an inability to at the margins to kind of figure it out, do the command and control, communicate exactly, and synchronize it. Mm-hmm. So Holloway rolls in and he looks at the whole thing, breaks it down, and says, you know, we need to have some type of central authority that does man, train, equip, and synchronizes across the different forces. Because they need radios that need to talk. They need to have common tactics, techniques, and procedures. We need a command or an entity to be able to do that. And they need their own budget so that they can take the Marine Corps helicopter and make it a soft helicopter, the Air Force aircraft and make it a soft aircraft. So, and that's kind of what SOCOM does now. They take the CH-47, the cargo helicopter, and they turn it into an MH-47 by adding a refuel boom to it and advanced avionics and upgraded engines and so forth. So as he's laying all this stuff out, there's a bill attached to it, both in manpower and logistics and money. And so Department of Defense looks at it and says, "Woo, man, we're not doing it." And they sit on it.
Dog scratching.
Exactly.
Dog scratching.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I got two of them sitting right here. Come here, buddy.
I can hear them.
And you don't see my wife off camera going, trying to get the dogs out of here.
All right. Sorry. You were saying the DOD said no.
Yeah, DOD sits on it. And because it's just a lot to process. They're a big entity, slow to move. Likes big aircraft carriers, understands that, big planes, big bombers, tanks, exactly. Yeah, hey, call us when you want us to fight a real war, not these little skirmishes. So that's how the Department of Defense is. And it's just a big, it's hard to change these things. I mean, it takes the changes in something like DOD is measured in 10 years, tens of years. Mm-hmm. And
so we're lucky it only took seven to stand it.
Exactly. But see it. So they were going to get around to it. Mm-hmm. Congress stepped in and then they legislated into the National Security Act. And they said, hey, listen, we need to do this because you saw like some of the groups were changed. We were saved from the chopping block. Mm-hmm. You saw you saw first group get re-stood up in Okinawa and in Asia. Seventh group was saved. You saw third group get stood up. I mean, so there are bits and pieces that they were looking at, but this whole command thing was flummoxing because there was two courses of action. Do you make soft its own service, which a lot of people, to include the soft guys, didn't want. And or do you keep it? Do you have another command step in, run by a 4-star that does man, train, equip, budget? And so finally, that's what the Nunn-Cohen Amendment to the National Security Act. That's what they actually did. And so they legislated SOCOM into existence. And so now you had the ability to command and control troops through JSOC. You had the ability to man, train, and equip, and finance. So now, from that, we got our own schools, selection assessment, those kinds of things. And so that kind of got us to where we're at now. Now, one of the things that they also did through the Nunn-Cohen Amendment was they gave us an advocate in the Beltway. And one person's advocate is another person's oversight. But mm-hmm. the advocate in the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict is the guy that now advocates for SOF in the Beltway. And true, he does have an oversight role as well because he's got to go back to Congress and say they're spending the money wisely, they're task organizing wisely, they're doing the things that we all agreed that we wanted them to do. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword. And but they didn't, I think it's a good thing. As long as it's the right guy that's in there that kind of understands SOF and knows what they need and kind of can explain why they're doing what they're doing, to the people that control the pocketbook, I think it's a great relationship. So, but again, DOD a little uncomfortable with it. So they didn't fill that position for about a year. So it wasn't, and then the Congress kept prodding and they put an assistant secretary in that position. And that's what we've had ever since. Like I say, I think if it's the right guy, he's the guy that's acting as the prerogative finger and he's getting you the money and the resources that you need, from the DOD. But he's also answering to Congress and answering any questions that they may have.
Mm-hmm. So the advocate role.
The advocate role, exactly. I'm a glass half full advocate guy.
Good. Glad to hear it. And that's a position that we think should be raised to an undersecretary, correct?
I think there's a lot of good reasons for that to happen.
There's enough reason.
Some we've already just discussed, you know, the fact that a lot of times he doesn't get a seat at the table. Mm-hmm. You know, he's easy to dismiss. And I'd like to see a guy that's less easy to dismiss, that can actually, you know, get in the face at DOD and say, no, this is why these guys are who they are. This is what they're chartered to do. These are the resources that they need in order to function. And then you can also turn to Congress and say, hey, these guys need these resources. And when Congress says, hey, are they doing the right things? He can say, hell yes, they're doing this, this, and this. So I think an undersecretary role for that would, especially with what's coming on the horizon. I don't know if you're looking at the stuff that's going on in Korea right now. The whole world is now becoming this volatile place. And I think, you know, SOF is aptly suited to step into that role, to be able to, in the great power competition, you know, to demand, train, equip, work by, through, and with. I think that's one of the things that we do best.
Where were you actually during the mission?
During the mission, I was either a corporal or I might have made sergeant by then. And there was actually two missions. There was Eagle Claw, mm-hmm. and then we continued to train post Desert One. They had a mission called Honey Badger, I think is what it changed to Honey Badger. Check me on that.
No surprise, Rick is correct again about the operation being called Honey Badger.
Two, if you will, that was a much larger force. That went in. So on the first one, I was part of the team that would go into Manzaria or Mansaria, and that was the exfil airfield. So we had they had the guys that would go into Desert One, secure Desert One, refuel the aircraft. They would go to a remain overnight site, and then they would go in and actually take down the embassy, get the hostages. Then they'd fly to us at Mansaria. And the thing about Mansaria or Mansaria was it actually had tanks that could roll, and it had a substantial garrison that was nearby. So there was going to be a big fight there. And because we would have
never happened.
Yeah, exactly. We would have to hold that airfield for as long as we needed to in order to get, because then they would be transloaded from the aircraft onto a C-141, a jet airliner, hospital ships that would then take them into launch duel. And into Germany, and then make sure they, you know, pass their checkup and stuff. So we never got to execute that. And then on the second mission, I had probably like the Mac Daddy spot. If you look at the embassy complex, you know, there's the Chancery building. There's a big square roof, and then a couple wings that come off of it. And me and one other Ranger, that was our domain. We weren't going to fast rope because there were some obstacles, but they could get a tire onto the corner of the roof, and then we would jump that gap, roll onto the roof, and then we had the range card that showed where our shots were, the direction, the distances. I think we had a machine gun, we had 203s, M79s, and a sniper rifle, and we had rope bags attached to our legs, so that. Yeah, we could tie off to an anchor point on top and then rappel off the back of the building and then run to the soccer field, which was our exfil point. And that would have been a good mission.
But that did not end up happening.
Negative. No, actually, we were still out training for the mission. And we were in a day room, and we saw the hostages come off. It was right, you know, 1980 when Reagan took over. And
I'm sure you were happy to see them freed, but were you also a little disappointed?
Oh yeah. We were deflated, and obviously you trained hard to do it, and but yeah, it all worked out in the end.
Good. Well, you saw plenty of other action later, so.
Yeah, story of my life. It was a good run. I had a great run.
Yes, you did. You're still doing it.
That's true. Hanging out with you guys.
Yeah. Not quite the same, but, you know, you'll take it. All right. Well, thank you, Rick. I appreciate it.
Soft Spot is brought to you by the Global Soft Foundation, a 501c3 based in Tampa, Florida. If you're new to us, you can find out more about the foundation at gsoft.org. That's Gulf Sierra October Foxtrot.org.